everybody, and welcome to The Christian Contrarian. I'm Gary Wayne, author of the Genesis 6 Conspiracy, and today's episode 8, is Agag and the Amalekite Bloodline. In previous shows, we discussed about how important understanding the players are that come out of prehistory, whether it's the fallen angels and the Nephilim and the royal bloodlines that set up the metallic dynasties talked about in Daniel and Revelations, and the religious organizational structure that all works together in how it affected prehistory, how it affected history down through the ages, what it's doing today, and how it's going to bring about the end time. So if we're going to understand what those relationships are, we need to dig into some of these key relationships to have a better understanding as to what's going on, both in prophecy and in history. And we're going to talk today about an interesting individual that comes up in Esther, chapter 3, verse 1, and he is Haman. And he also comes up throughout various chapters in Esther, and in chapter 3 and as well in 9, he is declared as an individual who is the enemy of all Jews, and he is a king around the court of kings of the empire and subservient to the emperor Ahasuerus. And he has all of these kings that are working in like a ringlord's table. A knight of a round table is another allegory you might understand it as, of kings that are ruling the known world. And Haman is an Agagite, which is a very interesting title when we understand he is also an Amalekite. And he's amongst these princes of this king's court. And he is the most favored amongst all of these kings of this ruling court of the world empire. And this is very, very similar to what Sargon did way back as an Assyrian, Akkadian king goes back to very shortly after the flood. And he is known to also have had this order of kings that he had canceled. So basically vassal kings and perhaps the princes or the sons or the actual kings perhaps that would sit at this table in honor of the new conquering king and would help rule through advice but still subservient to the empire. And so this is part of those metallic empires that we were talking about just a couple of minutes ago, where you have seven major empires that I think are Assyria, Egypt, and of course Sargon and the Babylon and the Persian kings that are part of the Daniel prophecies come out of this same sort of area. And then you have Greece, and then you have Rome, and then you have the new Rome of the end time world empire. And the ruling class, right back to Sargon, right back to Nimrod, right back to Rephaim, are Rephaim bloodlines. And so all of the dynasties of the ancient world derive out of Rephaim bloodlines as they usurp very on in the post-Diluvian world all of the kingships. And from a secular perspective, as we've talked about in previous shows, you have the Merianu or the Tawatha Danu or the Tawatha Danann or the Lords of Anu or the Scythians are all the same individuals. But from that polytheist perspective, these are the Rephaim that show up after the flood, who move into the Middle East and intermarry with Nimrod and begin these dynasties of Assyria and Babylon and Sumeria and all the various kingdoms in that area. And they are people that are known as the Merianu that start the Mitanni kingships and the Hittite and the Kassite kingships. And they're also going to intermarry down through the geography as they move west into the Covenant Land, into the Saudi Arabia region, and also into Egypt. So they're going to intermarry and become part of the bloodlines of Egypt, of the Amalekites, of the Hittites, of the Horites, and all of these Rephaim nations and Rephaim kings are going to be intermarrying to keep those bloodlines pure and control of the kingships. So we're starting to see, as we talk about this in detail, how all of this organizational structure that's designed to keep humankind below the noble class, because the noble class is just their cousins and second cousins and third cousins, and the humans are the servants and they are the slaves, they're the working class, and it's all about control. And so we understand that Haman is an Agagite, and what's important about that term is that Agagite goes back to a bloodline of Amalekite kings, or Amalekim as I like to call them. And Agag has an etymology coming from the Hebrew word, as it's recorded in the Old Testament, of H91 Agag, but it's a foreign origin, but it means over top or to rule or a ruler or a flame. And in Arabic, it means burn or blaze. And in Assyrian, which is the connection here that we need to make, because I think this is part of that intermarriage and part of that heraldic patronymic inheritance of titles, that Agag becomes a title like a Caesar or a Pharaoh. And we're going to talk about another one before the show is over. But understand, an Agagite title or a Agag is not necessarily the name, but a title of the ruling king of that bloodline. And in Assyrian, it's Agagu, which means tyrant, warrior, and violent, just as the Amalekim are known to have been very violent warrior nation. And we get this patronymic and heraldic understanding of this being passed down through thousands of years in a couple of other instances, because Agag, or which Agagite derives from, is mentioned a couple other times in the Bible. And we hear about it in 1 Samuel in the time of King Saul, when Saul is crowned king, and part of his kingship covenant is to wipe out the Amalekites for what they had done to Israel during the Exodus. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that later on in the show. And of course, King Saul attacks the Amalekites, lays a punishing blow on them, but captures King Agag and does not kill him as he's instructed. And Samuel comes along and actually has to slay Agag to fulfill God's instructions. And because of that, King Saul is going to lose his kingship and the bloodline that's going to go on with that kingship. And it's going to move to the house of Judah, which was prophesied very early on in Genesis. And King David is going to head up that bloodline instead of King Saul. And so we also have Agag that is going to show up earlier on in the Bible and in the time of the Exodus again. And again, when we have that war between Israel and the Amalekim. And in Numbers 24, talks about Agag as being the Amalekim king. That is, it's this great, powerful king. And it's there to have us understand that this is one of the more powerful kingships and powerful bloodlines of that time. But we're also told in Numbers 24:27 that Israel's future king is going to be more powerful than Agag. And that's quite a comparative when you think about it. Just let that sort of sink in, that this Agag king is going to be compared in the same sentence to a future king of Israel that's going to be more powerful. But just that connection suggests how powerful this king and this bloodline is. And I think this king could represent either King David, or it could represent Jesus, as he's going to be become known as king and Messiah and going to be reigning over the millennium. And I think it probably is representative of both. So this was a very, very powerful king of that time and a very, very powerful bloodline that is heraldic or transferred from generation to generation in a patronymic sort of way from a patriarch. And so we're going to examine a little bit closer who these Amalekim are. And we learn about the Amalekim in Genesis 36. It's not the first reference, but we're going to start there because it's just easier to unravel things. And in Genesis 36, We have Eliphaz, who is the son of Esau, who is son of Jacob, or I mean son of Isaac, is and firstborn son of Isaac. He's the one who loses the birthrights. He loses the Messianic blessings and loses everything that comes along with becoming a firstborn son. And so this is not something that goes over well, and it's carried on in an almost a blood oath throughout the generations, and it's going to manifest its time in the time of the Exodus and also with the time of Haman. And so that's, 1,000 years difference in timing in terms of when all of this happens. And I'll demonstrate again a little bit later that it carried on even from there. And so this is the land of the Horim. And in Genesis 14, we also have the Amalekim also mentioned, and they were also in the land south of Judah, in an area called Kadesh. And this is an area that is close to where the Horim lived around Mount Seir. And Kadesh is associated with the Kadmonites, as you take that back in its etymology and its meaning as Eastern peoples, just as the Kadmonites are part of this Eastern people. And that's sort of the KKK of the Kadmonites, Kenizzites, and Kenites that are mentioned amongst the nations that in Genesis. And I think this is a connection back to that Mesopotamian bloodline connection that we're talking about, that they're going to name that desert area in the Saudi Arabia region right by Egypt, Kadesh. And so Eliphaz, back in Genesis 36, marries Timna. And Timna is a Horim, daughter of Seir. And Seir is one of the first and more important chiefs of Edom. And his name goes back into Hebrew as Satir. So you see all of these Rephaim connections, just as you have all of these Rephaim bloodlines, and they're controlling all of the kingships, not just the metallic dynasties that we talk about in Daniel, but all of the royal kingships for the most part down throughout history. And their son is going to be named Amalek, which is very odd because you have an Edomite and a Horim marriage here, and they're going to use an Amalekim name. But that just shows you how closely related the Amalekim are to the Horim, which is very, very important to understand in terms of what is happening down through history. And so when we understand who these Amalekim are as they show up in Genesis 14, this is well before Genesis 36 in the chronology of events. And so we know that these are giants, because they're included in Genesis 14 in the war amongst giants. Just as we know Horim in Deuteronomy 2 are classified as Rephaim, and so are Amalekim classified as Anakim, and Anakim in Deuteronomy 2 are called Rephaim. And where I make these connections is during the spies of Numbers 13. They come back with a report, not the evil report part that's embellished, but the actual report before you go into the evil report story. And they report, Caleb and the spies report back that they saw many nations, including the Anakim and the Amalekim. And there is nothing that stops when it talks about the, Sheshai, Ahami, and Talmai. And Talmai is another heraldic king that shows up in the time of King David with the Geshurites. But I digress. There's nothing to separate when they're talking about the Anakim to the Amalekim. It's the next sentence, and they're talking about it in the same breath. And I think that's the connection, that they are actually considered part of the Anakim, and the Anakim are part of the Rephaim. And we know that these are giants because of Genesis 14. And so you have this new Amalekite nation being formed in Genesis 36, which is distinct and separate from the Rephaim nation. So I think this is a hybrid Rephaim nation that Eliphaz and Timna are creating, and name them Amalek, who are going to create this hybrid nation that are going to have Agagite, Agag kings being named there from there on, And we see that showing up in the time of King Saul, and also Haman being called an Agagite. And these are the people that are going to attack Israel, the hybrids, not the true Rephaim. I think you got two different branches, maybe living amongst each other, but two distinct branches of Rephaim and hybrid Rephaim and humans. And it's the hybrid branch from the Edomites that are going to be the people that are going to attack Israel as they come out of Egypt, and they're trying to wipe Israel from the face of the earth, and they're trying to re-inherit through wiping Israel from the face of the earth the Messianic blessing and the birthright blessings that Esau had previously lost to Jacob. And so when we understand these connections, we can now understand what's going on in history. And these people that are known as Amalekim, Josephus in Antiquities chapter 3 talks about them as being the most warlike nation. And so this is a very powerful warrior king, just as the Assyrian word that we used, Agagu, calls them a violent nation, and warriors and tyrants. I think we have a consistency that's going on down through history as to who these people are. And so when we understand who the Amalekites are in 1 Samuel 27, it talks about them in the Shur area, which is that southwest desert region close to Egypt, but not up as far as Mount Seir as you move inland. They're called the Nation of Old. And that goes back to Hebrew as meaning to antiquity and ancient. So that either means before the flood or immediately after the flood. So they're like the aboriginal inhabitants of that area, just as the Hori, the Horim, as you take that back to Hebrew, are also known as aboriginal people who settled into the Mount Seir area and what we would know as Saudi Arabia or Edom today. Before the Edomites settled there. So that's why the Edomites intermarried into them. They were there, and obviously, many of the Edomites were carrying on this sort of blood oath of losing those birthrights that they felt Esau should have had. And as we talk about how this comes about down through history, we also need to understand that these are a people that are so almost a DNA that is involved in this blood oath. So it's important to understand that this blood oath hasn't died and it's going to resurface in the end time. And I think you can expect descendants of these people and follow those names as it's talking about these nations of Edom, for example, in the end time. And I'm going to make that connection closer to the Edomites and the Amalekim, because we know that most all the Amalekites are destroyed. And David comes along after Saul, and in chapter 2 Samuel 1 and 8, essentially wipes out the rest of the Amalekites, except for maybe a few. But somehow, Haman and this royal bloodline survives into the time of Esther. In the time of the Babylonian exile of the people of Judah. And this can only happen in one of two ways, is that for some reason some of Agag's bloodline from the people that David had taken care of survived and migrated away. Or it could be that other purebred Rephaim race that is sort of a separate nation that were living in other parts that carried on this bloodline, and that's how the Agagite title comes to Haman down the road. But either way, we have a survival of that bloodline into the time of Esther. And I think how that happens is through, after David is done removing the Amalekites from the land and taking revenge for what they had done in the time of the Exodus and trying to wipe Israel from the face of the earth, they gave them that kind of justice, because the Amalekim are never heard of after that. But the Horim are. And the Horim, and mixed in with the Edomites, show up in the time of David as well. And David's warring with those nations. And we come across another patronymic and heraldic title of Hadad of the Hori. And so in David's time, we get some clear names of this that are quite visible. And this is, again, we're talking from the time of the Exodus and the time of Genesis. We're talking over 1,000 years that these titles are being continued on with, just as Pharaoh would, as the example I used before. And so you have, Hadadezer, and you have Ben-Hadad, or son of Hadad, and King Hadad in 1 Kings 11. And so Hadad, what's interesting about that name is that Hadad is another name for Baal. And Baal and Hadad, that name as Hadad comes out of the Ugaritic texts. And Ugaritic texts are connected to the Rephaim and a Rephaim nation and Rephaim writings. But, people might be familiar with the book of King Og that talks about that, in terms of that era and who King Og was being a Rephaim, even though Og was in a little bit further east in Bashan. But the Ugaritic texts talk about the Rephaim, and were thought to be rulers of that region, just as the Hittites were in that area as well. Now you also have this understanding that you have Ben-Hadad is son of Hadad. So are they now talking about the son of Baal? Or is that just sort of that title that then comes down? Whatever it is, it's a title that sticks with many, many kings of several different kingships of that region. And I would also suggest that Molech would be the first Ben-Hadad, because Molech is the son of Baal, and Baal is the son of the Cainite god El. El is the parent god. And when you see, look at the spelling of Al and Baal, it could be just as easily spelt as El, because Al or Eel or El are just different transliterations of the same word in the Middle East. So now we have this reigning of kings that go beyond King David, beyond King Solomon, and continue into later periods of history. And I also want to show you how long that this is going to connect in terms of that Hadad title. If you go back to Genesis 36, you also have Hadad, who's king of Edom, and he may even predate Seir. So this starts very ancient after the flood and is going on beyond the time of King Solomon. And so this is the kingship that is going to come down through to history as being the kingships and the bloodlines of the Idumeans, as they are known more in that period of history than the Edomites. And it's just, again, a transliteration of basically the same name. And these are the kings that are going to produce another very, very famous king in biblical history, and that is King Herod. And King Herod marries into the Hasmonean dynasty. And Herod was the son of Antipater II of Edom, and his mother was Cypros of Petra, which again were more Edomites. And so these were the Edomites that were appointed to rule over first Edom and then to rule over Judea later. And it's actually Julius Caesar that's going to take this bloodline family and transplant them into ruling over the Jewish people of Judea. And it happens through a marriage and Julius Caesar. As I mentioned, Herod marries into the Hasmonean dynasty to sort of make kind of a royalty bloodline reconciliation there. Now the Jewish people are very, very upset at this, and you can imagine how outraged the people would have been at that time to have Edomites who hate them, who've tried to wipe them from the face of the earth, have warred with them all the way through. And in fact, just a few hundred years before that, they had made Edomites subservient to them, but also granted them rights, which opened the door up to what then translated with them being allowed to rule over Idumea again, and then being transplanted into the land of the covenant. And so King Herod of Edom has these, I believe he has these Amalekine bloodlines that survived within the Horeem kingships, because they would have intermixed with them, the survivors, and the royalty of those bloodlines would have been intermarrying with the Horeem because they're sister branches of the same type of Rephaim. And these are the ones that I think came down through Haman. And also, as those bloodlines continue to pass on, are going to produce Herod. And Herod is one of these kings is not only is he hated, but he is the one who is going to continue this blood oath. And so this blood oath is now going to be a significant part of Christian history, because he's the king who is trying to murder Jesus, and prevent Jesus from gaining his messianic title, and also what he would have thought at that time to become the king of Judea of that time. And so he tried to kill Jesus while he was still a baby, and he was always working actively to find out how accurate these rumors were to prevent this from happening. And again, this is all about stopping the messianic bloodline and also inheriting the birthrights and the blessings that Jacob, whose name changed to Israel, received over Esau. And we see this blood oath rise with in history, not only at the time of the Exodus, but also at the time of Herod, also at the time of Haman the Agagite. And I think we're going to see that bloodline be actively part of the persecution of the Jewish people and Christians in the end time, and also awakening Israel. So it's very, very important to understand these bloodlines as they come down through history. And so as you're reading prophecies going forward of the end time, and there's a lot of end time prophecies about Edom in the end time. And I would start to read those in a vein that this is not talking necessarily about who you might recognize as Edom today, but as the descendants of Edom. So whether or not the people of Saudi Arabia are actually those people, or the Edomites actually migrated around the world, we need to somehow identify where these people are today, because they're the ones that are going to bring about a lot of this destruction in the end time. And these kings out of the east migrated into Europe. So I think we could be looking towards some of the European kingships and royal bloodlines holding these Edomite bloodlines that are going to bring about some of the genocide of the end time. So if you're wanting to get some more information on what I was talking about tonight, get a hold of me through my website, thegenesis6conspiracy.com. That's Genesis 6, the number 6, conspiracy.com. And ask for by subject area, or as close as you can, so that I can send you the documents. I have actually a 7-part series, and I'm going to be talking a little bit more on the next show about this continuation of this Agagite bloodline, and how it sort of rolls forward and how important it is. I have a 7-part series on it. That's how much information is involved, and I will link that to prophecy. And if you want to know more about the Hadad bloodline, it's also in there, and also in the 13-part series that I do, the 14-part series I do on the Nephilim Wars, just as the KKK and the Kadmonites, and linking that to Kadesh is also in there. So you can get a hold of me on that as well. And also in those series, you're going to have these connections where you have, where I was talking about the Mitanni and the Kassites, and that's going to come at the end of the Agagite series. So as we put all of these players and understanding together, it starts to become quite clear how important it is that you understand prehistory to understand prophecy, because so many of the players, the organizations, and the religion is defined within prehistory and early post-Diluvian history. And the Agagite bloodline, the Agagite blood oath, and the Amalekites and the Edomites are one aspect of that. And then particularly how that spills over into the European bloodlines that are behind most of the secret societies, part of the what people would know as the 13 families, and part of the larger bloodlines around the world of other Rephaim bloodlines, whether it's in China, whether or not it's in South America, or whether or not it's in India, wherever, these bloodlines are still active today. And you need to understand who's behind the curtain pulling things. So you've got more than just fallen angels, you've got the religious aspect, and you also have the bloodlines and the kingships that are pulling the strings and trying to bring about the end time. So thank you for listening. And see you next time on The Christian Contrarian. Thank you.